Well, hey, how are you today? It's time for Ask the Tech Guys. I'm Leo Laporte. Coming up, why do people keep putting notes on my EV when I'm charging it at public charging stations? Sammable Sammet explains.
And I'm Micah Sargent, and I, plus Leo, walk you through Safari Profiles, a new feature in macOS Sonoma.
I didn't even know it existed. And then we're going to talk to a businessman. He prints candles and wrapping paper, and he wants to show you how. We'll show him how to show you how next on Ask the Tech Guys.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Ask the Tech Guys with Micah Sargent and Leo Laporte, episode 1995, recorded Sunday, October 8th, 2023. Acknowledging the sneeze. This episode of Ask the Tech Guys is brought to you by Miro, the online workspace for innovation, where your team can dream, design, and build the future together from any location. Tap into a way to map processes, visualize content, run retrospectives, and keep all your documents and data in one place. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com/podcast. Listeners of this program get an ad-free version if they're members of Club TWiT. $7 a month gives you ad-free versions of all of our shows, plus membership in the Club TWiT Discord, a great clubhouse for TWiT listeners. And finally, the TWiT Plus feed with shows like Stacey's Book Club, The Untitled Linux Show, The Giz Fizz, and more. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit, and thanks for your support. Well, hey, how are you today? That's Micah Sargent on my left.
And that's Leo Laporte on my left.
Oh, gosh. Well, I was doing stage right.
You're right. You're on my right.
Yeah.
I get it now.
Anyway, hi. Phone number 888-724-2884. If you want to call us, now's the time if you're watching live. But if you're not watching live, don't. No, you
or
could.
Do.
But you'd have to leave a message.
Yeah, leave a voicemail during the week. We'll be able to answer your question. You can also get in touch with us a couple of other ways. Call.twit.tv is the URL that you can go to.
So this is for a phone call.
Yes.
What is for a Zoom call?
It's like Zorro.
That's a Zoom call. Call.twit.tv.
Or maybe Zoom.
Zoom.
I don't know if people want to do that, actually.
This should be something.
Yeah, it probably is.
I think it is. If so, it seems familiar. Yeah.
Zoom call.
Oh, I know what it is. It's from The Prisoner. Be seeing you.
I'll be seeing you.
And then then you can email atg@twit.tv.
Yep.
Okay.
Oh, got through those.
Oh.
What's email?
ATG.twit.tv, ATTG@twit.tv, AsTheTechGuys@twit.tv.
Yeah, so they all work.
Yeah, but I figure if I give them one, it won't be so confusing. ATG@twit.tv. Or if you mistype it, then it will probably still work.
That's the best way to
put it. Maybe that's fair. You know, Zoom actually is in the news. Tuesday, they're going to have their big event, which they call Zoomtopia.
Zoomtopia.
And they are going to announce an AI Google Docs competitor, an AI-powered workspace that listens to your call and then uses AI to edit, draft, summarize, include meeting notes. Plus, it will eventually have all the Google Docs Word processing and stuff like that.
And they've already added mail to this. They've added AI summarizations of meetings. They've added you can do your calendar in Zoom. So they're really, it's giving Microsoft Teams at this point.
Oh, that is. It's a team vibe. That's exactly what it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Teams that Microsoft just updated to be half as big and twice as fast. Or is it twice as big and half as fast? I can never, be sure. A little word of warning from the Federal Trade Commission. You've heard of them?
I've heard, yeah. FTC.
They say Americans have lost billions and billions of dollars in social media scams. A golden goose for scammers. Look, there's a hooded.
Oh, I saw
there's
that
a hacker
scammer.
In a hoodie. Yeah, that's
the
a scammer.
The hooded hacker.
It's a new report because it says social media just opens you right up. In fact, I read a related story about, this is actually a terrible story. Elderly woman who was a big fan of the Bee Gees.
Mm-hmm.
And she was on a Facebook Bee Gees group. And there was a button that said, message Barry Gibb, one of the brothers. And so she did, and she got in this conversation. He said, I can't send you a picture, but I am Barry Gibb. She said, well, and I love you. Oh. I'm deeply in love with you. She said, well, what about your wife of 50 years? I'm going to leave her for you, but I want you to buy us a love hideaway in Oregon so I can come move up there with you.
No.
And here's the name of a good realtor in the area. Now, I think there's a number of red flags there, including my bad Australian accent.
Go ahead, sorry.
But I
thought he was Cockney.
Now, he's from... actually, I think they were born in England and then moved to Australia.
Oh, well,
so
then
you're
that's
not wrong.
And you're not wrong. That had a mix. That's a pretty good accent.
Anyway, it wasn't, needless to say, Barry Gibb, nor was it a realtor. She sent $11,000. She said, my life savings to this guy, and
that's
it's gone,
awful.
Of course. So that's an example of a social media scam. She was catfished.
Mm-hmm.
I saw it on the Catfish channel on YouTube. So the FTC says social media gives scammers an edge in several ways. And I'm saying this, too, because our audience knows this.
They would have
tell your loved ones.
Exactly.
Because it really is older people who are lonely and maybe not so technically aware and perhaps not so wary as we might be of strangers. The FTC says scammers can easily manufacture a fake persona, Barry Gibb, or hack into your profile, pretend to be you, and con your friends. Now, that's happened to us.
Yes, all of
Do
us.
Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, yeah. I and Jason Howell and also several people that like Jason Snell had this happen to him as well. They are creating fake profiles. And here's the clever thing that they do. They start by blocking you. So if I'm the fake Micah Sargent, I go to Micah Sargent and I block Micah Sargent, because what happens is then I am not able to see this account. I don't know that it exists. So they took my name and they just did my first name and they put a period between it and my last name.
And it's really easy to do this because all your pictures and everything can just be sucked
They're all right
down.
There. Exactly. You can suck them out. Then you can also set it up to where it follows the same people and then they just buy followers.
It's way too easy to do this on Insta.
Exactly. And so the only way that I knew about it was because a friend of mine texted me and said, I don't think this is you that's saying this message to me, is it? And the same thing with Jason. Jason had it happen two or three times. Howell had it happen two or three times. And you have to have everybody that you know go in and say, this is a person that is attempting to be another person. They're lying about the fact that they're this person. And it can take a long time for those to go down. I think one of the fake accounts for Jason Howell was up for a while.
It's gone now. I was going to my messages because he messaged me.
Oh, wow. You got
saying, let's be
too.
Friends.
You're like,
and I was going to show it, but it's gone now. So, yeah, it was taken down.
And it
yeah.
ended up being because Jason had one of his friends kind of follow through a little bit just to see where it was going to go.
Yes.
And it was a...
Guess
yeah,
what
can
they
you
wanted.
Guess?
Guess what they want?
Cryptocurrency scam.
Got a great investment for you.
Yep.
I'm going to be rich.
Hey, I'm really getting into this crypto thing lately. Have you heard about it?
Well, and that goes along with, and this is another venue, I think, or another vector for attack, text messages. And we're all getting those text messages.
I get them from Lisa all the time. They're not actually from Lisa.
Oh, my. You're still getting them?
Yeah. But what's funny and what's That's foolish
hysterical.
Is that they're using her former last name in almost all of them. It's always signed Lisa K.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's weird.
Yeah. And so then I immediately
they're not
know.
They're super smart.
Yeah, no, they're not. They're pulling from online databases or data buy.
Well, in fact, that's one of the reasons that Lisa uses one of our sponsors, Delete Me, because what they, you know, this all stuff is all online, right? If you ever search for yourself, it's all online. And so what they do is they'll look for executives in companies and they're able to get, because it's all kind of on data broker sites and other places, kind of get the hierarchy.
Yep. And they'll use LinkedIn for it as well.
Yeah, LinkedIn. Lisa's on LinkedIn. And so I'm not on LinkedIn, by the way. It might be why I don't get involved
Yeah, I never get
these.
Any messages from you.
Don't start. this is not an invitation to demonstrate your prowess.
Yeah.
So they get the tree of responsibilities, and they say, oh, okay, Lisa's the boss. Here's her subordinates, and they message those people.
I need you to please go to the store and buy 15 Apple Store cards, and then I need you to send me the codes for those. Because we no
You'd
seriously
have to be foolish to fall for that.
It's
right?
me, it's Lisa, and I need these Apple.
I need
store.
It. I'm in a meeting right now. I can't get to the phone.
This reminds me of there's a video of sometimes they'll have like YouTubers or TikTokers or whomever who know what's going on and they like scam the scammers.
Don't do this, by the
no,
way.
No, no, no. Yeah, you should not. What was fantastic about this one though is that the guy was pretending to be an elderly woman who had gotten the codes. And when it came time to give over the codes, she went on to the website and started redeeming them herself, the codes that she just bought. And so she's like, oh, yeah, I'm on the site. I'm redeeming the codes. The scammer was getting so mad. She was redeeming
the
codes.
No, don't redeem the codes, lady. Give them to me and wait a minute. No, I'm Lisa Ketzer. No, don't redeem the codes, lady. Doesn't work.
It was almost exactly like what Leo was just doing. It was really funny to
watch.
So
you don't have to do it. You've seen it now.
Yeah.
Hey, speaking of scams, this is not a scam, but it's a scam in a way. It's a scam. Elon Musk, that genius, that business genius, has decided he doesn't like the aesthetics, how Twitter looks with all these links. So from now on, when you post a news story on Twitter, it will have the picture from the story. You can put whatever headline you want, but it doesn't show the headline of the story from the site, nor does it show the link. It just shows the picture and your headline, and then people have to click the picture to get to the story. As a result, a number of jokers on Twitter have posted headlines like Elon Musk announced his endorsement of Joe Biden for election, or Elon Musk... Here he is. So this is what it looks like on Twitter now, right? You see the site, fortune.com.
Oh, because you can't see the headlines, so you don't know what that
the
actually
actual
is.
The actual article here is the story Fortune had about Elon removing the links. there's another one here. Elon Musk, formerly Elon, comes out as transgender. Axios.com. Even a kind of funny-looking picture.
Yeah.
That's not
what this is.
These are all people, by the way, they're all getting banned for doing this because Elon doesn't like to be called out. Here's one. Elon Musk found dead at Twitter HQ of apparent suicide.
Oh, no.
Points to the same Fortune.com article saying. So these, I think
it's showing.
Are saying, look, this is the problem.
Which is exactly what they did with the checkmark accounts in the beginning, too.
Yeah.
Showed how easy it was to make it look as if it was someone else saying something.
So let me just be clear. Elon is not transgender. He's not coming out as transgender. He's not endorsing Biden. And he's not dead. So those are all hoaxes. Mm-hmm. But very difficult with the new Twitter to spot them.
You know what's stupid about this is if the whole point is to get people to stay on your site... Why would you make it so that the headline goes away? Because we all know, I know, many of you, you just read the headline and you move on.
Yeah.
But now you have
to click it.
And you believe it. Now you have to click on the article to actually go and read it. So you're leaving the app.
That's why sites like Reddit, which allow you to do this, post these news articles, but you can say what the subject of the message is, will almost always have a little thing, modified headline. The moderators will say the headline is not the same as the headline in the article. Just to let you know that this is not the actual article's headline. But Twitter has no such facility. So just beware. I don't know anybody who's still using Twitter, but please stop if you are. You're not doing yourself any favors. I think a lot of people think, oh, we're going to save it.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to save it. We're going to keep it good because if all the good people leave, then only the bad people will be left. Got bad news for you. The bad people are left.
I think they've left, yeah.
So you're not saving anything. 888-724-2884 is the number. I think I did mention Sam Abul Samad coming up in half an hour. Is that right?
Yep.
Our car guy, he's also going to be joining us on Twit this afternoon. So let's get some good car questions for Mr. Sam. What should we do, John Ashley? What do you want me to do?
You
want
to take a caller?
Well, yeah. I'm letting you choose.
Oh.
I see some hands raised in the...
I see Todd.
Let's raise. Todd's got his hand up. Hi, Todd.
Hello, Todd.
Hello, Todd. Welcome to Ask the Tech Guys.
Oh, it's an honor.
Oh, my gosh.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we are honored right back at you. Where are you calling from, Todd?
Alabama, Birmingham.
Birmingham.
I'm wearing the sweatshirt. Yes.
Oh.
And Leo. Oh, yes. And Leo, my nephew.
Wait a minute.
Nephew has
Roll Tide. Is that right? Am I saying that right?
You're saying that very well. very well. Yes. My nephew's actually been on Jeopardy twice. I heard you talking about
it. Oh, yeah. I was thinking maybe I should try because I play at home, as many of us do. We watch the show in the evening, and I think I do quite well. Lisa keeps saying, you should try out. So how does your nephew's experience?
First off, he was a genius at 2 years old. So he did very well. But he says everyone on there is a genius. It's just all how you do the buzzer.
It's the buzzer.
That's
what somebody else said to me.
That's the trick.
Yeah. You know, Glenn Fleischman is going to be on Twit this afternoon and has also been on twice. He won his first game, lost his second. I think he might have been the one who told me everybody knows the answers to almost all the questions. It's just getting in. Right? It's the buzzer.
That's what he says.
So, there is a guy who makes a practice buzzer.
No idea.
That you can buy. You can buy a practice buzzer. So I might do
okay.
that. Yeah.
Well, all right. So I have two questions kind of pertaining to the same thing.
Yeah.
One is I can't figure out is I'm starting a new business and I want to show people. I see people do this on YouTube all the time, a video of how to do it. And I see them doing the YouTube video and they also have a camera on themselves, and they're in the lower right-hand corner.
Mm-hmm.
So what software are they doing to be able to record something that they're doing on their computer screen and an image of themselves?
I'll tell you the most popular one, but there are many ways to do it. In fact, you do this on iOS today.
Yeah, and hands on Mac. Yeah.
And hands on Mac, and you use something called Ecamm. But most people who are doing this use OBS Studio. It stands for Open Broadcaster Software. As you can see, Windows, Linux, and Mac. I've used it on my Linux box to play Valheim on Twitch, and it allows you to have a camera input plus the screen input. You can mix the sound. It has a lot of nice features.
And it's free.
And it's open source. It's free. In fact, Twitch took the open source version and made their own version, which if you're doing it on Twitch, is probably a little bit easier to use. It is OBS
Studio,
but it's Twitch branded.
Okay.
Are you planning on saving it for later, or are these going to be live streams?
It's going to go on YouTube, and somebody clicks, how do I do this? It will just stream it to them. They can see how I did it.
Okay, yeah, so you're recording it for a YouTube video. Yeah,
correct.
So you can use OBS Studio to record as well.
It's really designed, though, for live streaming.
It is live stream
and
first.
It doesn't sound like you really want to do live streaming, that you would like to record.
I don't.
Okay. Are you on a Mac or Windows?
Oh, Leo, I'm on the Windows with 6 monitors.
Oh, nice.
Holy moly.
So I thought this factory floor you are on was just a green screen. Is this your basement?
No. No, this is my can I flip it? How do I flip this? This is my main business right now.
Oh, nice.
So it's just the stuff I do. Like this machine over here is printing wrapping paper.
What? Oh, man.
You should buy your wrapping paper.
Look at it.
Yeah, that's you all are printing wrapping paper.
How did you get so entrepreneurial?
Yeah. I claim because I'm Jewish.
No, that's not true. There are plenty of poor Jewish people. So, you said, was this from an early age that you said, I'm going to be a business guy and start businesses?
Well, I started business was always when I was young. And then when I graduated college, I became a stockbroker and I really stunk at
that.
Yeah, yes. You need to run your own place. Yeah.
Yes. So I do. So.
What's the name of what's the name of the wrapping paper business? I need some.
Leo, I only sell this on Etsy. I have other businesses. I've actually called you before in one of my other businesses years ago, but this just sells on Etsy. And during Christmas, you know, I'll sell a few thousand rolls.
Wow.
No problem.
Kind of love.
Are they custom? I mean, what is it that makes you unique?
Yeah, good question. No, they're good designs. They're good.
You're saying nothing. I'm exactly. Design. Yeah.
No. Well, I used to do custom stuff. Like I started out doing the custom socks. In fact, my ex-wife did a selfie on socks, and my friend Will said, we need to put this on Etsy. And I sold 999 pairs of socks in one night.
Wow. Holy moly.
All right. What's your wrapping paper business on Etsy called so I can look you up?
Oh, that is called, hold on, let me pull up the name. Amers, A-M-E-R-S, Phenomenon, P-H-E-N-O-M-E-N-O-N.
Oh, my.
Amers Phenomenon. So you don't really care about the name. You figure people are going to search for wrapping paper on Etsy and find you. Basically,
the name doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
No,
I just searched for wrapping paper on Etsy, and I found bacon scented gift wrapping paper.
What?
Uh-huh. Yeah,
I need to get that for somebody.
Yeah, I don't want to know how he makes it though. I'm thinking it's a similar setup to yours, but right under the printer, he's got a George Foreman grill and he's cooking bacon. I don't know. I don't want to know.
He probably does. Yeah.
You know, but that's what's cool about Etsy. Well, this is neat.
Yeah.
So if you don't, I'm sorry, you're on a PC, Windows. There are a lot of different ways to do, if you're not doing it live, you don't really need OBS. That's kind of overkill because what you really need is just some software that will mix your the output of the camera and the output of your screen, and then you control it. I know a lot of programs. In fact, I use one on the Mac I really like, but I don't know anything on Windows. You could use Ecamm, but again, that's live focused, right?
Well, no, but so I don't think Ecamm. I don't know about its Windows. I don't know that it works on Windows.
Oh,
does it?
Okay.
It is just as much recording focused as it is live focused. So, it's built for Mac ground up. So that unfortunately won't work. I would love to know what the folks at lynda.com, which is now...
they do great stuff.
Because they, and I can't think of what they're called now, LinkedIn Learning. They do this regularly on Windows machines.
I'm going to think they use Cam Studio or something like Cam Studio.
Yeah, does the chat have any suggestions for what you folks like to use?
You know they do. So can I ask my next question while they're waiting?
Sure.
Okay. So... the new company is going to send links to people every day, not spamming. They're going to sign up for it. They're going to get a link. I would like to do the links by text. How does when I go to my bank and I log in and it sends me a number to type in, how are they sending me those links by text?
We have a previous sponsor that could be very helpful.
Podium.com. So there are a lot of ways to do this too. You're thinking of Podium. And Podium is a service that allows small businesses to text their customers, but there are other ways to do this as well. In fact, years ago, I bought a Kickstarter project from one of our good friends. It's actually a friend of Steve Gibson's that had a built-in text messaging component to it, and he was using Twilio. So this is kind of the more low-end way to do it, which is Twilio. It's probably cheaper as well, but it isn't going to. It depends on how. You seem like a kind of a do-it-yourself kind of guy. So what Twilio is an interface to the phone system from a computer. That's what they sell. And the way it works is you'll buy a phone number from them, and you pay it's pennies a minute. There's all sorts of, the pricing is interesting. It's really based on traffic.
I've used it before. It's pretty simple in terms of, I wanted to create a custom way to like text myself something, and I was able to get that set up with Twilio and not spend a bunch of money.
No, it's fairly cheap, but if you're doing, it's all depend on, because that was one
how
person.
Much, right,
so
exactly.
It all depends on traffic.
Yep.
I don't think Twilio is too hard to use. This is, even something like Podium is probably using Twilio underneath it. This is there are a lot of businesses built on top of Twilio, like your business is built on top of Etsy, using Twilio as the interface to the phone system. So for recording, Cam Studio, which is free and open source. Cam Studio. I've used this on Windows. It will let you record does do exactly what you want. In fact, here's bullet point number one. Use it to create demonstration videos.
There you go.
All right.
So I've used this and it works very well. It's a really nice, simple system, and it's absolutely free. Then Twilio, which is, if you go to Twilio.com, it's not immediately apparent that you could use this for yourself. 10x your customer relationships with Twilio AI. Guaranteed protection from SMS prompting fraud and all that stuff. It's not what you really want to do is go to their solutions, and you're going to look at their phone system solutions. They have customer. You know, it's interesting. They have decided, why are we letting other people make money based on our hardware solution, our interface solution? So they're making their own high-end stuff. But if you spend a little time messing around with it, it's fairly inexpensive, and it's what everybody uses to get to the text messaging part. If that's too complicated, podium.com is also fairly inexpensive, and we'll do that all for you. It's Podium is really for like the dentist office that wants to text messages to customers saying, hey, don't forget to rate us, things like that. But you could use it for what you want to use.
Perfect. Awesome. All right. Well, those are my two questions.
Hey, I want to give you more plugs. What else?
Thank you.
There's a Betty White candle you can buy from the
Betty
Etsy
White
shop.
Candle?
Yep.
You do a Betty White candle?
I do an everybody candle until I get a cease and desist. And then I don't do that candle anymore.
So you also make candles? Wait a minute. I want to see your.
I don't make candles really. What I do, I used to make candles, but then I could go to the Dollar Tree and buy a candle for $1.25.
And you buy the wrapper around it.
I print the wrapper.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah. So.
These are like prayer candles. You make prayer candles.
They're prayer candles. Yeah. So over here are just all the candles. I'll send a file when somebody orders one. Oh, I print off six.
You're brilliant.
And so there's Kurt Russell.
Thank you.
Oh, that's a cool candle.
Kurt Russell.
Oh, yeah.
Can I get a snake? Can I get a snake Bliskin candle? That's Kurt Russell with a
Bliskin is.
Yeah, it's Kurt Russell with a black eye patch from Escape from New York.
I bet I have that.
Yeah.
I bet I have this.
I bet you have it. Look, he's looking for his snake Bliskins.
I have one question. Do you have a photo of Leo in there? Maybe we could do a Leo wrapping paper.
I will not sue you if you do a Leo prayer candle, I promise.
Well, since I'm the one who sent you all the socks, I already have the Leo collection.
That's who sent us those socks.
Okay. I sent you the socks.
Love those socks. Yeah. Thank you.
My pleasure. Micah, you want to know why there weren't Micah socks, but there are not enough pictures of you out there.
Fair enough. I'll have to get some more out there.
I have a question for you. I wasn't sure. Can I wash those socks?
You can wash them.
Or will Leo fade?
They'll never fade.
Yeah.
No, it's all something called sublimation. You'll never fade. Like, I do that sock the exact same way I do this mug.
A Wonder Woman mug.
Yeah, it's the exact same process. You can do anything synthetic.
There's Grinch wrapping paper that is delightful.
So do you make a lot of money? should I do this for my retirement?
like two years ago, I made like over $100,000 a year.
Nice.
But Etsy's gotten so saturated now.
That's why I need to branch out.
Starting a new business. Well, I have other websites. But
that's the key, isn't it? Is to always
diversify.
Be doing the new thing, right? The next thing.
I have 20 websites.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you sleep at all?
When do you sleep?
I have six kids.
Holy.
I have plenty of labor force.
Oh, you also have plenty of incentive.
I see.
Yeah. Now, I have a big labor force.
No, I know why you keep starting businesses. Hey, I'm so thrilled to meet you.
Yeah.
Again, I guess we talked before. Thank you for the socks.
Yes, thank you.
And I just call in once in a while. Let us know how it's going.
Exactly. Follow up.
Oh, Leo, you might remember my first call I called you about was I had a wall of stickers and I couldn't read the stickers on there.
Yes.
And I'll show you. That's the wall.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
Yeah.
And
those
look at
all stickers.
Oh, you've got the little ladder.
Is this your basement, or do you have a warehouse?
Yeah, is this a warehouse?
No. I have a 3,000 square foot. I used to have a 47,000 square foot warehouse, but now I have a 3,000 square foot warehouse on my property.
I think you have a lot of energy, my friend.
Yeah,
and
Thank you.
Your mind is in constant ferment at coming up with new
ideas.
Thank
you very much.
I'm definitely buying the Prison Mike mug.
Prison Mike mug.
It's Prison Mike
on Etsy. I love Prison Mike.
Hey, I have a Prison Trump in the exact same outfit too.
Might as well, right?
I have Trump. I have Trump in the exact same bandana, and I've sold only one of them. I thought I'd sell 100.
You never know, do you?
Yeah. The worst part about prison was the Dementors. They were flying around.
Yeah. Shows you I had no idea, yeah.
So how do you get the ideas for this? Do you watch a lot of TV? Do your kids say, Dad, we need to do a Prison Mike mug? By the way, you're not alone.
They'll do stuff. Yeah, I know. Yeah.
There's the saturation you were talking about.
You could put something on Etsy and have it knocked off in
five minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I made this awesome shirt for Michigan. Their coach, Jim Harbaugh, I made a shirt and it said, have a blue Christmas because their colors were blue and they say go blue.
Yeah.
And I thought it was my $1 million idea. There were 50 other sites with it like the next day.
Yeah.
And there's nothing you can do about it. So that's already, why I'm getting into something else.
Since we started talking, a prison mic prayer candle.
Oh, wow.
So it's just you cannot win. Yeah. You cannot win.
You can't, you can't win. Whatever you do, it's going to be out there.
You are winning because you have Chihuahua wrapping paper.
What?
So
I do.
Did you do that knowing that Micah would fall for you?
Yeah. Did you know?
No, I think I sold. I think I sold one roll of that in the history of having it up there.
Well, you're about to sell another.
So you print on demand? Oh. I would guess you don't print these all ahead of time.
No. Yeah. It's only on demand.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what
if people in the chat room who want to compete with you? What is the name of the printer you use?
Well, I have two printers. I would not get this. This over here is called Mamaki. This is a Mamaki. And it's got a UV light, and every time the light hits something, it dries it.
Ooh.
But this one over here, this one you could buy this one for like $3,000. It's an HP design jet, and it's like 10 times faster, and you could buy a used one for nothing now. And it prints a little bit better, but I'm waiting for a new head to come in. So the thing is, you have to have two printers of everything when you do this because something's always down.
Hey, it is such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Yeah,
thanks for showing us.
And, my pleasure. All right, I'm glad.
We now know a secret to his productivity. Whenever he runs out of ideas, he orders a new head. And then it comes in and you got more ideas, right?
good idea. Yes, thank you.
I need a new head myself. Great to talk to you.
Yes. Me too.
Wow.
You too. Thanks.
888-724-2884. That John Ashley was an excellent selection.
Yes, good work.
Give us another one.
Yeah, don't let us go down from here.
I do have another one idea, but I need help with something else first.
Is it an ad break?
I was trying to get to that, but yes.
Sorry, I didn't let you didn't let you segue into that. My bad.
You know, subtlety is not necessary, honestly. Good thinking. Maybe this would be a good time to tell you a little bit about our fine sponsor, the Oxford English Dictionary. I shouldn't have clicked twice on Miro because I got, you know, have you noticed that on the Mac that it often accidentally, maybe it's just the way I type, opens the dictionary. Yeah. It's like, I know what the word the means.
Please.
I don't need help.
Yes.
Thank you. Our show today brought to you by Miro. And, you know, this is... we were talking about this on Wednesday on Google. Google has discontinued their Jamboard, their $5,000 physical screen that you would brainstorm on and stuff like that. And people who bought it, I feel so sorry for you because end of the line and early next year, they're just going to like disconnect it. But you know what Google's telling people? Go to Miro. And you know what?
They?
You should have gone to Miro in the first place because you instead of $5,000 for this thing, your first three boards are free. What is Miro? Oh, it is the ultimate tool, the online workspace for innovators. What does that mean exactly? Well, it's a great place for you and your team to bring your innovative work together. And nowadays, with teams located all over the world in different time zones, some of them are in the office, some aren't, you need a single source of truth, one place where all the ideas go. That's Miro. It's packed with the right things to be, for instance, if you're doing product design, product development, your dream product's home base. Our last caller could use Miro to brainstorm his next brilliant idea. We're talking... For product, specifically product development, six whole capability bundles from product development workflows to content visualization. And here's the nice part, and this is new, all powered by Miro AI. That means you're generating new ideas or summarizing complex information pretty much instantly. Let the AI do it. Miro can work for any team, but product development teams really get the full experience. It offers teams the richest feature set of any visual workspace with specific tools to help with strategy or process mapping, facilitation tools to run effective design or agile sprints. You can have your swim lane or your Kanban. You get the picture. Miro connects super seamlessly to all the tools you're already using. We use it with Zapier and Google Docs. If you're in product development, you might use Jira or Confluence. Google, of course, Asana, of course, so you could centralize work in a way that makes sense for your team. And here's why this works. They don't have to leave Miro to update projects or statuses in any of these tools. It all is inside Miro. When you stay in one tool, get all the benefits of the other tools, you don't have context switching. You don't leave ideas on the table. You don't forget about stuff. It's all in there. It ends up being a massive time saver. In fact, Miro users report they save, I love this, up to 80 hours a year per user. That's like an extra 2 weeks of vacation every year. By streamlining conversations, cutting down on meetings, seeing all the most up-to-date information in one place. That's your Miro board. Miro just released a board. This, you know what? He could use this. A board video recording feature called TalkTrack to save even more time. We're talking about pre-recording your thoughts and just leaving it on the board. Now you don't have to schedule another meeting. You just say, hey, here's my ideas. And then people can leave comments. They can leave suggestions. They can leave their own talk tracks. It's super powerful. And here's the best part. Your first three boards are free. Because Miro knows once you start using it, you're going to get it. It takes a little, you know, you have to spend some time with it to get all the things you could do. And then the light bulb's going to keep going off. Going, oh, I could do this. I could do this. I could do this. It's incredible. Take a look at the Miroverse, too. It's on the website for other people's ideas, ways they use Miro. It really can fit any workflow, any style of working that your team wants to use. Even for an individual, I find it great for brainstorming. M-I-R-O, Miro.com/podcast. Your first three boards free. Start working better together at Miro. Miro.com/podcast. It's mind-boggling. This is exactly what computers and software were designed for, and the internet was designed for. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a perfect expression of it. Thank you, Miro, for supporting the tech guys. Now, I think we have time for one more thing. What, do you have a voicemail there?
Yeah, I think a voicemail.
Okay, J.A., go for it.
This is Lori calling from Tampa, Florida.
Hi, Lori.
My question is, when Copilot is integrated into Windows 11, will it have direct access to data on the computer's hard drive, such as documents, downloads, etc.? If yes, can that access be disabled? Thank you.
Oh, she's thinking privacy.
Mm-hmm.
So yes and yes is the answer. So one of the great Copilot, which is Microsoft's version of OpenAI's ChatGPT, they're using the word Copilot in a variety of settings. There's Copilot for GitHub, which does computer programming for you. It's a programming partner. But as you probably know, Microsoft announced this a couple of weeks ago at that big event. They are going to start building this into, it's already got Bing Chat in their Edge browser, and they're going to start building Bing Chat, aka Copilot, into Windows. That's part of, I think, 2024 H2, I think,
mm-hmm.
or 23 H2. I think it's coming soon if you don't already have it. Part of the value of it is you could say, yes, summarize everything in this folder. So it does have access to that, but you don't have to give it access to that. And you don't, I think what I hear you saying, Laura, is that you're worried about Microsoft having access to your documents, your private information. And Microsoft's pretty clear that they're not going to do that. That it's completely permission based. It is true, though, and a number of companies have said we don't want our employees using these tools. It is true that in many cases, that information is then sent up to the server for the work. And I use ChatGPT. You have a choice of turning that off. You could say, no, protect my privacy. Now, you have to trust them. You know, that they're going to do what they say. But all of them are very sensitive to this now. So here I am on ChatGPT-4. I subscribe to this. And you can go into the settings. And you can, there is the whole thing set for data controls. And you can say, you know, where this stuff is going to end up. You know, is the data going to be saved on your server? Do you have control of it? You can turn off history so that no history is saved. Remember, this is a website. This is not running locally. You'll have the same controls, and I think even better when they put it on Windows, because nobody would use it.
Right.
If it started training on your personal data, that would be a big deal. I will point you to this article. This is Microsoft's support article. Copilot in Windows, your data and privacy. So as they point out, it's in preview right now, but it will soon come to all Windows. And they will explain to you what they're saving and what your choices are. So you can absolutely say, do not share this data. And they have lots of information about how do you control that. So this is a Microsoft support article. It doesn't have a number. If you just search Copilot in Windows, your data and privacy, you'll find this article and some related articles as well. Copilot is Microsoft's flavor ChatGPT, basically, or Bing Chat. They've called it by a variety of names. I think it's probably a good idea, but this is something you're not alone in worrying about.
I have to tell you, Leo, I remember a couple of weeks ago where you said something about how you felt like what we were going to see was people starting to say, I don't want this here. I don't want this here. And I was a little skeptical at the time. Because I have seen the helpfulness, and I felt like if we could get these large language models into a part of our operating system, that it was more down into it, that we might be able to see the value of speeding up certain processes that we do. However, as time has gone on and we've started to see it pop up in more places, I use a delivery service for my groceries because I'm a bougie fool called Instacart, and it has now AI built into it so that you can say, I want to make this food, and then it will give you recommendations for what groceries you should purchase based on that. However, they're also tying in where they are getting, you know, these deals and discount. It's more than just, here's some suggestions for things to buy. It's also, here's some suggestions for things to buy, but also these are our best partners who also pay to have their stuff sponsored. So there's a lot that goes into it that's kind of behind the scenes that makes me feel kind of ugh about it. And I don't know that like you were saying, I'm starting to feel that a little bit. Do I want you putting your peanut butter AI into my chocolate? I don't think I do. I want to leave my chocolate alone.
Yeah. There's going to be a backlash for sure, right? We're already seeing a backlash with Amazon's Echo and Google's Assistant, where people just don't want those things in their house listening, even though I almost said we know they're not listening to you and sending everything back to the home office. But I guess we're pretty sure would be a better way of characterizing that. There'd be a lot of traffic if they were taking everything you're saying and sending it back to Amazon. So I don't think they're the privacy invasions a lot of people think they are. But nevertheless, this is all starting to add up. And I think people are really reasonably concerned about, you know, how much information we're giving to big companies. And furthermore, it's very obvious big companies want that information and are monetizing that information. So they're strongly incented. So that's why there's this, to me, this a little bit of a lack of trust now. They say no, but how would you know? Right. How would you know? And so I think there is going to be a backlash. You've seen the author backlash. People like Sarah Silverman and George R.R. Martin saying, I don't want my books to be used in training AI. That's actually an interesting position, and probably, we'll see, these are court cases that are ongoing, probably can't be supported.
Right.
Because I can read your books and ingest them and use them in my thinking. Why can't a machine do that? You know, you publish those books. Ian Bogost, who is an author but also writes for The Atlantic, had a good article. My books were used to train Meta's generative AI. He writes, good. It can have my next one, too. He says, and I think this is the other point of view. These things will only get smarter if we all contribute into them.
I think we saw that also from Jeff Jarvis. Jeff Jarvis was saying, I want it to be trained on my stuff.
So these are both completely reasonable. I guess I've given up on privacy. It's a shame that privacy is so important and I really want privacy, but as somebody in the public eye anyway, I don't think I had much.
Right.
I've ever had much. I just don't know. I think you should have the choice. And good news, Microsoft says you will have the choice in answer to your question. as long as you trust them. Because there's no way, really. This is the problem. How do we verify? No, we won't use your data. So great question. Thank you. This is the time of the show where we would like to talk to a man named Sam. Sam Abel. Sam Edit is here. He is our car guy, principal researcher at Guidehouse Insights. He's also the host of the Wheel Bearings podcast at wheelbearings.media. Sam Abel. Sam, join us in the Stargate. Hello, Sam.
Welcome.
You're going to be on Twit later this afternoon, so I know there's probably a lot of stuff to talk about in the car world. I'll let you pick something for today's show.
Right now.
You. Okay. Pick.
Yes, me.
Pick something. Yes. What? Let me try this in a less oblique fashion. Hey, Sam, what would you like to talk about today?
Well, there was an interesting story on Jalopnik earlier this week about the headline was bizarre passive-aggressive notes for drivers of EVs without fast charging are appearing on chargers at the Dallas airport.
Oh, yeah.
So what this was all about, something that people that are getting into EVs for the first time should be aware of, is that just because you go to a charger that is rated at a higher speed, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're EV will be able to charge at that same speed. You know, every vehicle has a maximum charge rate that it can support. And every charger has a maximum charge rate that it can support. And when you plug in an EV into any particular charger, it's going to choose the lesser of those two. So, for example, if you have a Chevy Bolt, a Bolt can DC fast charge at a maximum of 50 kilowatts. If you go and plug that into a 350 kilowatt charger from EVgo or Electrify America, it's still going to charge at 50 kilowatts. It's not going to charge at 350. There are vehicles that will charge at or near 350 kilowatts, including stuff like the new Chevy Silverado EV, the Hummer EV, the Lucid Air will do, I think, about 280 or 290. And Hyundai and Kia EVs will charge at about 240 to 245 kilowatts. And that's significantly faster than a Bolt. So what happened here at DFW is there's a charging station. There's an EVgo charging station where they have one 350 kilowatt charger and a pair of 150 kilowatt chargers. And somebody got frustrated, and I understand the frustration because I've been in the same situation where apparently they found somebody using the 350 kilowatt charger with a vehicle that could not support anywhere near that charging power. I had a similar situation about a year ago when I was testing the Genesis GV60, which will charge about 240 kilowatts. And I went to my local EA station, and at the time, this is before they replaced most of the chargers with all 350 kilowatt chargers. There was two 350 kilowatt chargers and four 150s. And as is often the case at an Electrify America location, one of the 350s was completely out of order. The other was being used by a Bolt. And there were other 150 kilowatt chargers available at the same time. Mm. So, you know, I didn't say anything. I just went home because I live not far from that charger. I just went home and plugged in at home. If you have a vehicle that's capable of charging faster, and let's say you're on a road trip, you probably want to get charged up as quickly as you can and be on your way. So, you know, the note that was left on the charger was this applies to owners of Bolt, Hyundai Kona Electric, Nissan Leaf, and a few others that are slower charging. This charger provides 350 kilowatts, but if your car is not capable of using it to full capacity, therefore you're impeding faster charging cars from using it. Faster charging cars can get in and out quicker to the benefit of everyone. Please show courtesy and use one of the other chargers to the left. And though for cars with under 100 kilowatt of charge rate, you will not experience slower charging on these, as they will still charge faster than your car can handle. Please educate yourself on how EV chargers work. So that's what I want to do, is provide a little bit of that education.
That's fair. Reasonable. That's fair, yeah. But, okay.
Oh, however.
Okay. That's fair. I understand. And but first of all, a lot of EV owners don't know what the charging rate of their car is. That's not like printed on a sticker on the window. Right. And they may not know when they pull up to EA which are the fast chargers, which are not. It's not immediately obvious. That's problem number one. So a little education, that's good. And I would expect people who drive Chevy Bolts will now consider this and be courteous, and use a slower charger if they can figure out which is which. But honestly, the real flaw is with these people who, and I really blame EA. They have just done a terrible job of this, who've designed these stations so poorly that, sometimes you've got one, most chargers have two outlets. And if somebody's fast charging on one, you can only slow charge on the other. There's all sorts of issues with this. Couldn't they design a gas station that pumps at the same rate or adapts appropriately to the rate the car is available, so that there isn't this issue of, oh, you should use that pump over there because you can't take advantage of this pump over here? Shouldn't the burden be on, in other words, Electrify America, not on the consumer?
Absolutely. So
I'm just getting fed up with EA. Yeah. These guys have built a ton of stations. They don't maintain them. They're actually giving EVs a bad name. And it's because of them that we now all have to use NACS chargers, the Tesla charging specification, because people say, well, the CCS charging's terrible. It's not CCS is terrible. It's Electrify America, Audi.
And, well, I mean, to be fair, EVgo and ChargePoint have a lot of issues with charger reliability as well. But EA is far and away the worst. And EA, for those not familiar, is the company that was formed by Volkswagen Group of America a few years back, after they were discovered to be cheating on diesel and exhaust emissions. And as part of their multi-billion dollar settlement, they agreed to spend $2 billion to build out EV charging infrastructure. And what they did was they created a new business unit called Electrify America that built out, I think there are currently about 800 locations now across the U.S. with DC chargers. And they've done a reasonably good job of putting the chargers out there. What they haven't done is maintain those chargers. And they've done a really poor job of that. And there's a lot of reasons behind that. I don't have time to go into all of that today. But the reality is, if you go to an EA station and to a slightly lesser degree, an EVgo or ChargePoint location, there's a pretty good chance that one or more of the chargers will not be functioning. But to your point about having all of the chargers just be able to charge at max rate, the EA actually is moving in that direction. My local EA station that is about half a mile from me here has six chargers, and when they originally installed it back in 2019 or 2020. They four of those were 150 kilowatt chargers. The other two were 350s. And last fall, they ripped all those out, and now they just have all 350 kilowatt chargers across the board. So they are moving in that direction of what you said, of just make them all the same, and whichever one you plug into, they will adapt. And to be fair, chargers have always adapted to whatever the speed is that the vehicle can handle.
They step down. But if you had four high-speed chargers, then it wouldn't matter which one the Bolt used. Because
yes, exactly. Yeah. And that is now the case, at a lot of the stations.
They can do that. I don't understand.
They can.
I don't understand why they haven't, though. Well,
A 350
kilowatt charger. So does maintaining your charging stations adds cost.
A 350 kilowatt charger is significantly more expensive than a 150 kilowatt or a 50 kilowatt charger. That the electronics and everything that have to go in there adds a lot of cost to it. And considering that none of these companies are remotely close to being in a situation where they are making profits, then,
even when they charge,
this is part of why
a buck a kilowatt hour, they're still not making money on it.
I don't think anybody's charging quite that much.
No, but there's some very expensive ones.
Yeah. And part of it is,
a lot of the charging stations remain underutilized. It's the classic chicken and egg problem.
Right.
People don't want to buy EVs if there's no charging stations out there. On the other hand, if you put charging stations out there before people are buying EVs, they're not going to get used, and then you're not going to generate revenues, to be able to fund the operations and upkeep of those chargers.
Let's just say, though, just in defense of EVs, because I have three, and that's all we use now, is that most of the time, for most people, you're charging at home. You don't really have to worry about these stations. They're for long road trips. And there are some people who have long commutes who need these or don't have stations at home and need these. So for those people, this is an issue.
Let me address that, though, okay? The reality, right now, the people that are buying EVs, and we're still very much in the early adopter phase of EV adoption. We're at about 7.5% market share for EVs in the U.S. right now. So it's still very, very much early adopter. And you have to remember that most people do not buy new cars. We sell about three times as many used cars in the U.S. every year as we sell new cars.
Most people are
smart. Well,
I'm the dummy who buys a new car every 3 years.
Most people also can't afford new cars.
Yeah. And used cars are a good value because cars depreciate so rapidly. The minute you drive off the lot, you'd be nuts to buy a new car.
But when you look at who buys new cars versus those that buy used cars, new car buyers tend to be somewhat more affluent. They are much more likely to have dedicated off-street parking available.
That's right.
So they can plug in and charge at home. When you look at the people who buy used cars, close to half of used car buyers do not have access to dedicated off-street parking. They live in apartments, townhouses, condos, or even in older urban neighborhoods where they have to park curbside. And so charging at home overnight is not an option for a lot of people.
Possible, yeah.
And this is one of the things that we have to address with the expansion of charging infrastructure.
And that's exactly the problem, is that these crappy charging stations are discouraging people from buying EVs. So it ends up being a small percentage of people who can, because they can charge at home.
And
I agree. My son, who's eventually going to move into an apartment, how's he gonna charge unless more apartment complexes put in EV charging, which would also be nice. I think this is just growing pains.
Or workplace charging.
This is all going to happen eventually.
Yeah. It's going to take a while, though.
I really wish EA was doing a better job. It's easy to blame them.
Don't we all?
And I am going to.
Well, and this is why most of the automakers in the last 4 or 5 months have done deals with Tesla.
Yeah.
And they've said, okay, we're going to drop CCS, switch to the NACS charge connector, the Tesla design charging connector, which also, as we talked about, I think last month, it's a better connector. It's easier to use. It's easier to insert and get out. The cables are thinner. So it's easier to handle. And they're also going to be able to have access to the Tesla
superchargers are so well maintained and they work well. And by the way, you don't have this issue of, on the supercharger network of, you should be using that charger, not that charger, right?
Yeah, they're
all the same.
At any given location, they're all the same. Not all superchargers are the same. There's a couple of different versions of superchargers that are out there. Some are faster than others. Yeah. And it's the older ones, as they've rolled out new ones, they've been installing for the last 2-3 years, the version 3, which will go up to 250 kilowatts. They've deployed a few version 4s in Europe now.
One of the reasons there are cars like Bolt that only charge at 50 kilowatts is that's bad for your battery in general to do that high speed charging, right?
It is if you do it all the way up till the battery is full.
Right.
So the problem is thermal management of the battery. The temperature.
Yeah, thermal management. It heats the battery when you're charging that.
Yeah, so you don't want to you have to have good thermal management of your battery, and then as you get close to full, you have to ramp down so you don't overcharge the battery. That's what damages the battery, the heat and the overcharging.
Okay.
And and in the case of the Bolt, the Bolt is an older design. It came out in 2017. And GM was trying to create a more affordable EV. So the onboard charging system is less expensive than, putting a higher power charging system on there adds more cost. And they were trying to create a lower cost EV at the time that that car came out 6 years ago. So they're, you know, the next generation, you know, the costs of those components are coming down, and you're starting to see faster charging capabilities, even in those more entry level EVs. But, you know, to what you said earlier, you know, about education, you know, that's another component of this, is that, you know, you know, there isn't usually a label on, you know, on the window somewhere saying this is the charging speed,
right,
that you
have
can
to look it
park
up
and support.
It's in your
well,
handbook.
You know, at the retail level, when these cars are sold, you know, I think it's incumbent upon salespeople to both be trained and educated on this stuff, and then to educate their customers. When somebody buys, you know, drives out of the dealership with a Bolt or a Leaf, you know, they need to be educated, you know, on what the capabilities are. Tell them, you know, this thing can charge at 50 kilowatts. If there is a choice of chargers at a location you've gone to, use the slower ones, you know, as a courtesy, because your car's not going to charge any slower. It's going to charge at the same speed. But those who have cars that can charge faster, let them use the faster ones so they can get in and out and more people can charge. And then, you know, or during the sales process, you know, explain, you know, this car can charge at 50 kilowatts. This one can charge at 150 kilowatts. Here's the difference. Here's why it might matter to you.
Yeah. I'm ashamed to say, I don't even know what my Mach-E charges at.
150.
So it's in the middle there.
Yeah.
It's pretty fast.
It's pretty fast. Yeah.
I have to say,
It'll do up to 80% in about 40 minutes.
Yeah, we have Tesla power walls. Power went out, as you know, John, power went out in our neighborhood for 3 or 4 hours the other night. And we just kind of I turned off the hot tub, but we kind of blissfully went along with everything working just fine on the power walls. And I was very grateful to have that. We have solar panels charging them up, and they kept our house online for a good 3 or 4 hours. I was very happy. So I like this whole process, but I understand it is at this point for the affluent.
It's complicated. It'll get easier as we go along, and more people become aware of, you know, about the limitations of certain EVs, you know, and get a better understanding of how charging works, and it's just in general as charging gets faster and more available.
Samet, I'm going to let you prepare, get your makeup on and everything for this afternoon, this week in tech.
I'll see you in a couple of hours.
Can't wait. We'll talk about this.
I'm looking forward to it.
A lot more car information. Sam is a principal analyst at Guidehouse Insights. You'll see his writing in a variety of magazines. He is more and more, I notice, called upon to talk about automotive technology as automobiles get more technological. His podcast is great with Nicole Wakelin and Robbie. I love Robbie. The Wheel Bearings podcast at wheelbearings.media.
Thank I just you, published this week's episode about half an hour ago.
What was the topic of the week's episode?
Oh, there's a whole bunch of stuff. Robbie drove the Lucid Air Pure, the base model.
Yeah, only $50,000. Ooh.
No, it's 80.
I'm sorry.
Only.
Only.
I had the Lexus RZ450, and Nicole had the Subaru Crosstrek, and we talked about a whole bunch of other stuff, too.
Nice. Samabul Samad, Roberto Baldwin, Nicole Wakelin, a very, very fine podcast at wheelbearings.media. And, of course, Sam will join us every month on this show to talk about cars. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a good one.
Talk to you guys later.
Bye-bye. Right. I'm going to pause before we get to our next call, because I'd like to talk a little bit about something near and dear to my heart. Did you see Ant's interview with John Scalzi? Yeah. Wow, that was cool. Thursday, sci-fi author John Scalzi joined us in the club.
In the club.
In the club with Bottle of Bub. The club we're talking about.
I'm impressed.
Go shorty. our club is Club Twit.
Yes.
And there is no champagne room.
Sadly.
In Club Twit. Every room is a champagne room. Woo! In Club Twit.
Bubbly.
started Club Twit about 2 years ago, Lisa did, because she recognized a problem that has now become widespread, that for some reason it was becoming more and more difficult to do ad-supported programming. And we thought, well, we've always wanted to really be listener supported. So we've kind of hedged our bets. We still want to do shows like this in public with ad support, but we also want to do more shows than we can do otherwise through the club. Plus, the club helps us keep all these shows afloat, as, sad to say, advertisers seem to be departing the podcast world. So how can you keep Twit going and flowing? Join Club Twit. Now, it's not expensive. $7 a month, $84 a year. In fact, there are no higher tiers. There are lower tiers for families and corporate sponsorships. What does that get you? Ad-free versions of this show and every show we do. You get access to the Club Twit Discord, where there's always something good going on. I'll tell you about some more events coming up in a bit. Plus shows that we don't put out otherwise, like Micah's Hands on Macintosh and Hands on Windows with Paul Thurrott, Scott Wilkinson's Home Theater Geeks, the Untitled Linux Show, and I can go on and on. There's a lot of great stuff in there. Coming up on the 12th, Home Theater Geeks recordings. You'll get to watch those in the Discord. Are you going to join us for the escape room?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, Micah, you did the escape room last time.
Uh-huh.
And the people who we did the escape room with, I wasn't there, are going to bring it to us.
Yeah, they have a portable escape room. And so they'll be bringing it to us. And it's, I think, wizard and sort of magic themed.
Watch us just become complete morons in person.
As we speed through trying to solve this.
And you're going to be sitting there. I know you are in the club going, I know the answer.
Yeah, exactly.
What's wrong with them?
How did they not think
so
of that?
Easy, you doofuses. Stacy's Book Club is a John Scalzi book, The Kaiju Preservation Society. It's coming up in November. Renee Ritchie joins us. He's the creator liaison at YouTube, the expert on how to be a successful creator on YouTube, also former host of MacBreak Weekly. He'll be joining Ant in a fireside chat November 16th. As will I, Jeff Jarvis, and Doc Searles, the old farts chat. That's coming up in December. And our AI guru here in-house, Anthony Nielsen, will be doing one early next year. That's just some of the stuff scheduled. There'll be more because Ant Pruitt, our community manager, is a hard-working fella, and he's always coming up with some fun stuff. We want to make it worthwhile, you know? And so the best way to do that is give you a lot of value for $7 a month. But I got to tell you, that $7 a month could very well mean the difference between keeping shows on the air and not, and keeping the lights on and not. And we really want to keep going with what we do here, because I think Twit's a fun place to be, and I enjoy it. And I'd like to keep doing it. If you'd be interested, go to twit.tv/clubtwit. Now I would like to do another phone call.
How about Rose?
Hello, Rose.
Star 6, Rose.
Star 6.
Mr. President.
Oh, I know you, sir. I haven't talked to you in ages. How are you?
I want to thank you for getting a phone number. There's no reason anyone should be subjected to my face full screen on their monitor.
So, yeah.
I really appreciate it.
First name and city,
you know,
sir.
After that first guy with 20 websites and 50 businesses.
Oh, and I know. He was an overachiever, wasn't he?
I feel like the vaudeville singer has been told he's following a comedy act with dancing dogs and children. I guess nothing
Never.
The audience is going to want.
Never do it. No, Louis, you're always welcome. Just tell us where you're calling from.
Hollywood, California.
Beautiful Hollywood. All right.
Family of San Francisco, go Niners.
Oh, thank you.
Yes.
Well, everybody's a Niners fan when it comes to the Dallas Cowgirls.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm looking for a hardware recommendation.
Okay.
USB-C is the preferred wired connectivity standard for now.
Yeah! Woohoo! Got the USB-C!
That's right. On the M1 Mac Mini, Apple offers just two USB-C ports.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't need one of those hubs that has a port for everything, C and A and flashcards and SD cards and all that. I'm just looking for a hub that has maybe four USB-C ports that provides data transfer and charging. There are dozens of makes and models on Amazon and other sites. Most, I've never heard the brand name. There are models that offer data transfer that don't offer charging and vice versa. Most of them are apparently not M5, so
I've got your answer. It is not an inexpensive purchase, but it is a solid purchase that you will be very happy with. It is the and you want more than charging. You want data and charging, correct?
That's right.
Yes. Then the
because this is going to get plugged into my mini. Mm-hmm. And so I have a couple items that just need charging, like a headset, wireless headset. And then I've got my iPhone and my iPad, that sort of thing.
You want the Element Hub from CalDigit. The Element Hub from CalDigit. So they make incredible docks as well. And Leo and I both use their docks. But CalDigit has an Element Hub. And on one, and I know you said you don't need a whole bunch of ports, but this is, it's just two. On one side, they have four USB-A style ports. And on the other side are four USB-C style ports. They're also Thunderbolt 4 USB 4. Those USB-C ports are. The other side is USB-A that's 10 gigabits per second worth of connectivity. It has then on the side of it, the one USB port that plugs in from the Element Hub into your Mac itself. It's a powerhouse, but it's got its own power source so that you can do that charging. It's a solid piece of tech.
How much?
You also have some other suggestions. Oh,
how much?
That's a good question. I'm on their
stuff
site.
CalDigit's stuff is fairly expensive.
It is. Yeah, it is pricey.
Where you really pay money for, and you don't need to do this, Lewis, is the Thunderbolt ports.
Yeah.
If you're just USB, that saves you a lot of money because Thunderbolt, the licensing costs, I think, are expensive. So a Thunderbolt 3 and Thunderbolt 4 hubs. We should explain, by the way, what the difference is between a hub and a dock. And and then there's extenders and there's... The lines, the borders are small, but the dock usually is a standalone device. The idea being that you'd leave it on your desk. Mm-hmm. And then when you get home with your laptop, you plug it in. So you're docking it, and it's already connected to all your peripherals. There's also portable little USB hubs that you might carry with you. What was the price?
It's $200.
Yeah, a little pricey. So I'm going to give you a couple of less expensive choices. One, this is a company that I trust, Micah trusts for Mac stuff, Otherworld Computing, mm-hmm. at MacSales.com. And I have used their USB-C travel dock. So this kind of is a mixture between a hub and a dock. It's only $49. It has 100 watts pass-through power. That's fine for your Type-C. But also it has... two USB Type A ports, an HDMI port. I know you don't want that. An SD card port. I know you don't want that. And USB-C. If you just want USB-C, Pluggable is another good name. We like pluggable stuff, and they make a 11-in-1 hub with all of those USB-C things. This is only $79. You may say, "Oh, I don't need a card reader or Ethernet port," but it's nice to have, especially
just
Ethernet, just in case. And so these are also have additional ports for monitors if you wanted to add a second monitor to your Mac Mini setup, things like that. And at $79, why not, right? So this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 USB-C ports, which is really nice for a variety of data devices and so forth. Belkin makes them. I don't know. I mean, sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad. Because they white label third-party stuff. Satechi, S-A-T-E-C-H-I, also makes a variety of these. I would say CalDigit is like the top of the line, right?
Yes.
Also the most expensive.
Yes.
Otherworld Computing, one step down from them. Pluggables at the same level as Otherworld Computing.
Yeah, I would say they're not as sleek in design, so if that matters to you, then that's something to consider. Pluggable specifically. But the others, they really do.
I like these because I use them with a laptop. So I'll show you. This is another one I'm using right now.
To follow up on that.
Yeah.
The cables on all of these are pretty short, so they'd be sitting right on top of the mini.
This actually is a little longer if you
the
pluggable.
Extension cables, yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't do extension cables. I would say get one that has the cable that you need. The pluggable's got some good distance on it. This is designed, as you can see, for a Apple laptop.
Yeah.
Because it's got two USB-Cs. And then you would put the laptop on top here. This is from, and then all the ports are here. I like this. This is from Hyperdrive. And I got to know Hyperdrive because they would do a lot of Kickstarters. Mm-hmm. And I had some very good experiences with the Hyperdrive extenders. So this is an unusual one that Hyperdrive makes. It's just specifically for laptops. I'm not recommending it, but this is a good example. And I only show it because we're using it right now. And by doing that, I've disconnected everything. So I'm going to...
When you said extensions, you're talking about extenders for USB-C?
What? I'm talking about, for instance, a cable that would go from... So that not everything's, you know, piling on top of the Mini. Uh-huh. I was looking for like a USB-C female to male that would plug into the Mac from the port, the extra port device.
Oh, I see. No, so...
I wouldn't extend the dock. You could have extenders coming out of the dock.
Yeah, and most of them I don't know about the ones Leo recommended. The one that I recommended, its port itself is just a port.
It's just a port,
comes with
and then
a cable.
You have a cable. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
So you can get it up to, you know, I think 3 feet is the Thunderbolt, you know, as long as they go, are willing
That's
to go.
That's right. Yeah, the CalDigit doesn't come...
It comes with one. It's just one. Yeah, it's not hardwired in, and it's 1 foot long. The cable that they give you, so there's plenty of space between it and the device. But yeah, as Leo is saying, if you do end up going with one that has the cord built in, it's better to not do an extension on that because you just want to have it as close to the metal as you can get it in terms of the connectivity. Otherwise, you might run into some issues where some pin is not transferring some bit of information and it just ends up being a hassle.
It also raises this specter of that Type C, which is really just a description of what the port is, doesn't tell you anything about the cable. And you can get... There's so many Type-C cables, and many of them won't do what you expect them to do and so forth. It's always better to trust the cable that came with the dock because it's going to be the right kind of cable. Everybody has run into this where you have I had the wrong cable, but it's no way of knowing by looking at it. I like this pluggable. But it is normaled in, so you'd have to go with the length of it. Good. The thing is, you can go to pluggable... Or Hyperdrive's mm-hmm. website, or OWC's website, MaxSales.com, or CalDigit's website, and you'll see a variety of these devices. Those are four good brand names you can trust.
Yep, agreed.
Excellent. Thank you. Leo, I'm going to be sending an email about a really sad AI story. I won't bring it up now, and hopefully you'll comment about it on the show.
I will read it, Lewis.
Really
thank you.
Really kind of scary and sad.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Gentlemen, have a good
Great
Sunday.
To hear from you again.
Yeah,
have a wonderful day.
Chat. Thank you.
Yep. Take care.
Bye-bye. I buy an inordinate number of these. I have. In fact, at this point, I have to kind of look and say, is this
which
Thunderbolt?
One is this one?
What is, they all look kind of similar. All the CalDigits kind of look the same.
Yeah.
I have one in the office. I have another one in the office that's a monitor stand. That actually might be good for a Mac Mini.
Yeah.
Who makes that one, John? Do you remember? Say again?
Anchor.
That's Anchor. Okay.
That's right.
So let me show you this.
Oh, yeah. Anchor does have a pretty good dock now that I think about it.
And I think this might be good for a Mac Mini because what happens with this is it's a docking station that is a monitor stand. Now, it's expensive. It's $250. But I use this in my other office. So you put the Mac Mini underneath. That's where mine is. And then it actually might even be high enough for a studio. And then you plug it into the Mac Mini, and then you have all these plugs on the side and the back that you can use. It's something smart. Like a Mac Mini, it's actually a great little organizer. So that's what I have in my office. You could use it with a laptop, too. I guess you could put the laptop on the stand.
That's pretty clever.
And you
clever.
Can see underneath they have the a wire... management system, so you don't have wires dangling all around and stuff. But kind of spicy.
Yeah.
$250.
It's only $75. It's $75 off right now.
Is it $75 off?
Yeah.
So it's $250 because of the discount, or you get extra?
No, I think you get extra off.
Oh, okay.
So that's a good thing. That would make it, $175. That's not bad. That's the Anchor 675 USB-C docking station. This might actually be the one, if price were no object,
mm-hmm.
that I would recommend.
Especially with the idea of keeping the cables out of the way,
mini.
Which you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, you could see how the Mini goes. In this case, he's using it with a laptop. I wouldn't but you could put the Mini, as I have, underneath it and the monitor on top of it. And it makes it kind of like an iMac.
Yeah.
Kind of.
And it's got some raising, so then the ergonomics are there.
Now, who is this guy with the... Is that David? I got to pick up David because I really love this
comic
book behind him or something like that. And he's had his hand up. He's a poor guy. He's got his hand up for hours. Hi, David.
Hey, Leo.
Where are you calling from?
I am in Ithaca.
Ithaca.
And I am your friend, David, who is at Cornell, who studies disgust.
Oh, he's an expert in disgust.
In disgust?
Yeah. Disgusting, you know, like
what?
Gross. Like disgust.
Yeah. I want to know more about that.
We're going to talk about it in a second. Okay. You got a podcast set up. Do you do a disgusting podcast?
Yeah, actually. Yeah. In fact, one of our early reviews was 1-star repugnant.
What's the name of your podcast?
It's called Very Bad Wizards, and we've been doing it for 11 years, Leo.
What?
11 years.
I'm so proud of you. That's wonderful.
Thank you. You were an early inspiration, of course.
So David introduced me to a professor named Jonathan Haidt. He doesn't like the word hate, who wrote a really good book about why the left and the right are having a hard time talking to one another. So this research that you did at Cornell, are you still at Cornell?
Yeah. I still am. Yep. Right here in Ithaca.
You were a graduate student when we met, I think.
I think I was an early prof already. I came out to the Twit Brick House because I was at SciFu over at Google.
Right.
And, are you ever going to have people back?
Someday. this is a separate discussion.
After
I get your question, I'll explain why we don't have people in the studio.
Yeah.
It's a longer topic.
Sure. Yeah.
I don't push that on the stack because we got a lot of big stack.
Disgust now.
Let's talk about disgust. So, your research, is it sociology or psychology?
Psychology, yeah.
Your research was very interesting and jibed kind of with my own anecdotal experience.
Yeah.
I don't want to paraphrase it.
Yeah. It's super simple. So disgust, an emotion that most researchers agree exists because it protected us. It's a strong motivation to avoid things that might poison us or might get us sick, you know. But
vultures and jackals don't have it because they eat rotten meat.
Right.
But we need it because they can digest rotten meat.
It's what makes us feel like something bitter that we put in our mouth might not be something we should eat.
It's why dogs throw up so easily.
Yeah.
Because they don't have the disgust gene that keeps them from eating it, but they do have the ability to get rid of it really quickly.
Oh, God. This is
so it's an evolutionary trait to protect us from eating bad stuff.
Exactly. And you have that characteristic face, sometimes tongue protrusion. You see it in little babies if you put
peas sometimes.
Exactly. Even from the moment they're born, if you put a couple of drops of quinine in their mouth, I didn't do this, but people have done this. They'll go like this. So it exists. It seems to physically protect us from getting sick, right? Smart of evolution to do that. But it does also seem to influence our motivation in other ways and our judgments. And what we've found, it seems to play a slight role in even the kind of political orientation that you have. So there are certain people who have a strong avoidance motivation. It's kind of related to an aversion toward novelty.
Oh my God, I'm already obsessed with this.
Oh, it's great.
The world is a risky place, and some people are a bit more sensitive to that.
I have some videos, actually, of people who are very sensitive to horrible things. Do not feed your baby lemons.
That's right. Yeah, those are great.
Is that the disgust reaction, or is that just like what the hell?
It's thought to be. So distaste is thought to be related to disgust. Of course, babies only once you put it in their mouth do they do that.
Yeah. So disgust would keep you from tasting it.
Exactly. Imagine like a bubble that's protecting you from getting anything too close to your mouth.
But the thing that to me is the most interesting, and the thing Jonathan Haidt has written about as well, is this notion that maybe people who, you know, there's different sensitivities. Maybe people who are really sensitive to disgust also tend to be more conservative, mm-hmm. because
they're avoiding novelty.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, that's right. And yeah. Exactly right. And it rears its head in ugly ways, right? So people who like to try to convince others that certain sexual acts are wrong or certain people who are different from them are wrong. They can use disgust as a way to get anybody to sort of like be strongly motivated.
So it can be used.
It can
as
play a
tool
role
as
in
well.
Hatred. Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
To me, it explains why people are so upset about drag queens and transgender people because in a way it gives you it explains it without being judgmental. It's
right.
Like, oh. I get it.
I think that's super important to understand where it comes from, because then I think that gives you the context that's needed and perhaps the tool set that's needed to, at the very least, understand them, but even maybe to get to a place where there can be some change.
That's
so important.
Yeah, that's right. And I always tell people, there's so much that disgusts us. You have to ask yourself, should my disgust play any role in whether I think it's wrong? So like sex between two people who are not me most of the time is disgusting when I think about it.
Right.
So, but I don't think anything about that, right? Picking your nose is disgusting. It's not wrong. So I think just paying attention to how these emotions might be influencing you and being a little bit more reflective about it is hopefully one of the things that comes out of this research.
And so this is what the podcast talks about.
Well, we started off, I do it with a philosopher, and we started off talking about psychology and philosophy of ethics. And then, as you guys well know, you have to find things to do for 11 years. Yeah. Yeah. So now we talk about movies, we talk about short stories, we talk about books, anything. But
You have a Patreon for very bad wizards.
Are there any?
Yeah.
Last, I'll ask this, and I'll stop fanboying out a little bit here.
Can I say I'm so happy to meet you, Mike. I've been listening to you for a while. Of course, I've met Leo in person, but I'm so glad to meet you.
Well, that's very kind. Yeah. It's nice to meet you as well. Are there any talks anywhere about this, or like a book or something? Because I just want to read about it.
Yeah, I haven't written a book. I have. It's not a TED talk. It was a TEDx talk that got promoted to the TED.com. So if you go to TED.com and look me up, you'll see a younger version of me talking about politics and disgust.
Beautiful.
And
that's exactly what I was hoping for. So cool. I'm
thank you so
to
much,
it,
Mike.
Or listening to that.
And there, it's The Strange Politics of Disgust. There he is.
Yeah.
There's also the book I referred to, Jonathan Haidt's book, The Righteous Mind, which is kind of tangential to your research, but related. I know you.
We collaborated about this stuff with him. Yeah. So I think he was an early inspiration for me and always sort of. Helped out my young career when he was already a well-known dude.
Nice. Thanks to you, we did a triangulation with Professor Haidt some time ago. But I think very interesting stuff. Very interesting. Anyway.
Well, thank you, Leo.
It's nice to have you on, David. What can we do for you?
Thank you. This reminds me of back on, was it Call for Help when you had an actual webcam calls at like
postage
stamp?
The camera was so bad and the internet speeds at the time in the early 2000s, late 90s were so bad that we would make people be on the phone. So they'd be holding a phone, they would talk, and then every second they would move.
Four frames for the whole call. Yeah.
This is a little bit better. This is a little bit better.
This is a lot better. Yeah. So one very dumb quick question. When I click on spam in Gmail and it says report and unsubscribe, is that alerting them that this is an active email in the same way that it would, for some of these more nefarious emails? Like I've just been curious about this for a while.
That's a really good question. So Gmail, among others, require legitimate newsletters to have an unsubscribe link. There's no law, as far as I know, saying that, but it is kind of the kind of internet ethics that if you are doing a newsletter, that it should have a link, usually at the bottom of the page, that gives you an easy way to unsubscribe. Gmail, when it's seeing that link and sees repeatedly that you're getting emails from these people, and notices that you don't read them, by the way, that's another signal you're giving to Gmail, will then give you that pop-up saying, hey, I see you don't read this. You want me to unsubscribe? But you can do it manually in any email. In fact, on Fastmail, I don't use Gmail anymore, but on Fastmail, I actually filter all my email for that unsubscribe link because that tells me it's probably a newsletter, and I put it into a newsletter package. Are you sending them a signal? Well, if you click the link, you are calling home. You're phoning the home office.
Yeah.
So, you know, if it's a legitimate newsletter, the only signal is David doesn't want to get this and they should unsubscribe you. Sometimes they give you an extra step if they're, you know, very reluctant. It's a dark pattern.
Yeah.
But it is. But absolutely, yeah. There's no guarantee that that is not a legitimate newsletter, but that's spam. And that all he's trying to do is find out, is this, do I have a live one here? And you, what you're doing, and it's very smart, and I hadn't really thought about it, is you're combining the advice that we've given many, many times, which is never respond to spam. Because when you respond to spam, they don't know whether there's somebody at that address, by the way. Spam, they send out millions of emails in each campaign in a minute or two. And those half of those addresses may be phony. They don't know they're real or not. If you respond to it in any way, including saying, stop sending me spam, you're telling the spammer, oh, there's somebody at the other end. And now they know they have a good email address. They're putting that in a separate basket for good stuff. So, yes, your unsubscribe is absolutely telling them that. I don't know any way around it.
Yeah, so when the Gmail unsubscribe button is, it's trying to be clever. And so what a newsletter person can do to make the system better is in the header of the email, they're meant to include something called the list unsubscribe header tag. This is an actual machine-readable URL.
So it's looking at a hidden header.
That's one way that it does it. If it has that, then when you click the unsubscribe button, what it does is it sends a message to the server from, it doesn't have to be from your account. It just sends a message to the server saying, unsubscribe this email. That's the automated way to do it. That's the way it should be working. However,
but it does have to have your email address in it, or it wouldn't know
exactly
who to unsubscribe.
It lists that.
Yeah.
The other method that it does is it finds, if it can't find that in the header, the way that it should be doing it, is that it goes through and finds in the email, wherever the email has that unsubscribe button Leo was talking about. And you may have noticed that at times it will bounce you to a page where you then have to go and unsubscribe. That is a non-ideal solution as well, because you're clicking and that click is of course registering. I stopped using Airmail, but what I loved about Airmail, the application, is that they had a clever solution for emails that I didn't want to receive. They would send because I had the privacy stuff turned on, so there was no register on the server when an image loaded in the email, right? They would send a bounce email to the server, like a mailer daemon. It was a faux mailer daemon, that was essentially bounce, suggesting that the email was bounced and then it wasn't delivered to me because my email was not real. And I wish that's what Gmail would do. Unfortunately, in these cases, it's relying on the newsletter service or whatever it happens to be properly setting this up. But if this is also spam and you're, you know, reporting it, it's likely they're not doing that stuff that makes it easy to unsubscribe. Right. So that unsubscribe button at the bottom is still sending that information over.
So this is timely, David, because Google announced a couple of weeks ago they're going to have new rules for email senders. Now, this is not people sending email from Gmail. This is people sending email to Gmail customers. And if you are going to send 5,000 or more messages per day, starting February 1st, you have to do certain things that will legitimize you. So if you're a spammer, you're not going to do this. And Google will then see that as a signal that you are a spammer and just unilaterally block them. This is, by the way, it's a mixed bag because Gmail is very aggressive to blocking spam, but that means a lot of legitimate mail also gets blocked because Google's aggressive and sometimes there's some false positives. So what they're going to ask people to do is set up email authentication, SPF or DKIM, for the domain. Now, spammers never going to do that in a million years. So right there, spammers are out. You also have to make sure you have valid forward and reverse DNS records. You'll have to keep the spam rates below 0.3%. You'll have to format messages according to a internet RFC message standard. You can't impersonate Gmail. There's a bunch of stuff, including for the subscribed messages, enable one-click unsubscribe and include a clearly visible unsubscribe link in the message body. So the fact that Google is going to enforce this is actually, I think, very good.
I agree.
Because it will allow legitimate senders. We're all subscribed now to newsletters that may send out more than 5,000 emails to Gmail customers a day. A successful newsletter will. This will allow real newsletters to be legitimate, to demonstrate their legitimacy. And Google will then pass it along. But it is also going to absolutely stymie. Authentication is a great way to stymie spammers because they don't want you to know who they are. So they are not going to do that. So
This is
really good news because Gmail is the number one email provider in the world. As Gmail goes, so goes the nation. It's going to make a big difference in terms of spam and spammers. Whether it'll stop spam, I doubt. But if a spammer knows they can't get through to Gmail, that's going to eliminate a lot of the viability of spam campaigns.
Right, right. Well, thank you.
Yeah,
I had another question, but I don't know if you're we're out of time.
Oh, give me another question.
Let's hear it.
Okay, so I'm in the fortunate position of being able to build a small little standalone, guest room / office / studio for myself.
Nice.
Thank you, and so it's getting built right now. I need real wired internet. Right. So it's going to be like 50 yards. You guys field questions like this all the time, but here's my specific situation. I really need the wired. It's maybe 50 yards from where I'm sitting here. And I thought of two options. One, they have conduit running from somewhere out there, but my modem is like on the other side of the house. The coaxial is on the other side of the house. I asked the cable guy who was last year whether it makes sense to get a separate modem and separate subscription and just install that there in the little new studio. And he said that could work. But one problem is if it's under the same address, the way that we distribute IPs is based on the physical address of your bill. And you might start getting interference with two different cable modems.
Yeah, he would want you to buy a second account. Don't do that. Ethernet can go, a Cat 6 Ethernet cable can go 100 meters, 300 feet. So you got plenty of space. It's plenty of distance.
Okay.
All you need to do, so your cable modem or your the one place you could plug in an Ethernet cable is here. Your office is 100 feet down the hall. You have to string a cable. Now, obviously, you don't want to run a blue cable down your hall. So go up into the ceiling or, through the attic or through the basement or through a crawl space, and you can wire it. That's what we did. I have a wiring closet with a Ubiquiti router and a bunch of, PoE switch in a hall closet. And we ran Ethernet cable all over the house, and it comes down into the wall, and there's an Ethernet jack. And it works beautifully. The places that need to be wired can be wired. Because if you use a good Ethernet cable, Cat 6 or better cable, you can go a long distance. And that'll Cat 6 will give you 100 gigabits. I'm sorry, 1 gigabit for 100 meters.
Okay. Well, if only my cable company did that.
Yeah, gigabits plenty. Right, exactly. Right. Gigabits plenty. So that's why you just put in good cable. If you've got conduit, that makes it a lot easier. But we didn't have conduit, but we just had somebody get up in the attic.
Okay.
And you had a guy down there. Can you see it? Yeah. He's dropping it down through the wall. That's all. Yeah.
So it might make sense for me to put my actual modem and router somewhere closer to where the coaxial comes in the house and run Ethernet everywhere.
Sure.
Rather than,
my suggestion is, put it central. Yeah. But you often don't have that choice.
That's
right?
What I ended up doing.
The cable comes in where it comes in.
Okay.
Luckily, so the town home I live in, luckily it had been run for cable television. And so I just went in where they had the little splitter and changed it so that the internet was coming in and I could just you know, route it from the coaxial that was in the wall in a more centralized location, and then router next to it, and then from there ran the Ethernet as I needed to.
John, our wire closet is down the hall. John, what's the longest Ethernet throw we have here? Do you know?
525,000.
So it would come from the hall all the way down to your office. So that's a good distance. That's 80 feet, something like that. That's a good distance. And we have no problem. It works fine.
Okay.
Ethernet's pretty good in that regard. Just use a good cable.
Yep.
Great. Well, thank you,
David.
Thank you so much.
Great to talk to you again.
Yeah, really good.
Now, let me go away, but you keep listening because I'm going to explain why we don't have. You can also add a switch. Yes. Thank you. John's reminding us you could put an amplifying switch in between if you had to, and they're cheap. So the reason we don't have people in the studio, of course, first it was COVID. It's kind of still COVID.
Sort of COVID.
You don't let me come here unless I test first. So seriously, Micah texted me last week.
I did.
You know, could you test before you come in here?
He was being breathed on by all of you fans.
Yeah, we had a nice meetup, met with 50 or 60 people in Green Bay, didn't wear masks. Got real close. Yeah. No mouth kissing, but, you know, some hugs.
So Dr. Mom would agree with me that it was reasonable.
I test all the time. In fact, we go through probably a box or two of tests a week because we always want to be safe coming in here.
Right.
So that's still kind of an issue. But the other issue is when we used to have open studio was when we were fat and happy. I'm still fat, but I'm not happy. And the problem is, in order to do that, we need a full-time employee. In this case, it was a full-time armed employee. Moses, we contracted with the security agency because he had to be licensed to carry and so forth. And he was the person who would greet you when you come in the door. Then we had an intern or one of the staffers come and bring you down. They'd set up chairs and all that stuff. Unfortunately, we're a little bit skinnier than we used to be. Not me again, but you for sure. and we just can't afford a full-time staffer just for people visiting. And obviously the staff that is here is working.
Right.
and if they have to get up every 5 minutes to let somebody in, they can't. People still come to the door. We actually have at the desk a little setup of, you know,
goodies,
swag.
Swag, that's what it's called. Stuff we all get.
If I'm here, I will often come and give you a tour. So, David, if you came to the door and it was a time when I am here and not on the air, obviously couldn't do it now, I might give you a little tour, much to the despair of Lisa and the staff.
Yeah.
Micah goes.
I'm fine.
Yeah, I'm not. No. One or two, it's fine.
Yeah. It's just a play by ear, so.
But we just can't afford to have open studio and have people come in and sit. I wish we could, because you know I like an audience. I love an audience. And I would love to have people come and watch Twit and so forth. And we used to get sometimes
to the energy.
30 or 40 people. It's wonderful.
Yeah. When iOS today, we'd have people in the audience.
Wasn't that great?
It was nice.
But we just can't afford it anymore.
Maybe if Club Twit continues to grow.
Yeah, I'm not saying no. And if you are a Club Twit member, that's certainly. Wear the secret sash that we sent you.
You know the one, and the secret password.
And we'll let you in. I can't promise if you come here and it's a good time and somebody's here and somebody can help you. They're not busy. You know, we'll plan
a whole trip around it.
Please.
I guess is what we're saying.
Yeah.
It would break our hearts.
And since nobody comes to Petaluma. Pretty much everyone has planned a whole trip around it.
Yeah.
All right. More of your calls coming up in just a bit. You're watching or listening to Ask the Tech Guys with Micah and Leo.
All right. We are back from the break, and we have a great question that comes to us from the club. Are you ready?
Yeah.
All right. So it's a little wordy, but I promise it's good. So we had a listener who says, I have a 13-inch MacBook Pro M1 with 16 gigabytes of RAM, and because of Leo, I have the coding bug. I have almost completed a certificate in data science from Harvard.
Yay!
Via EDX, and I am on...
EDX is great, yes.
And I'm on data camp every day. I'm using RStudio, VS Code, and a new SQL editor slash course that I have not looked at in a while, so I don't actually remember. I'm using Safari Safari tab groups, so I don't have everything open at once. In addition to the course, I usually have many tabs for things I Googled to find out how to do. So working in Python, R, and SQL.
Nice.
Anyway, I promised myself a new laptop when I finished the certificate. I'm handling larger data sets lately and more Safari tabs, and I keep getting warnings that I've used up all of my memory. These are annoying, but I wonder if I need more RAM than what I have. So, when I get my new laptop, I cannot sit at a desk, so it will need to be a laptop. What are the benefits of getting a MacBook Pro over an Air? I don't use a lot of ports. Would increasing the RAM be important? I'm also thinking a larger laptop would be better for increasing my typing speed, as I do miss keys sometimes on the 13-inch. By the way, I am thinking that I would then have two laptops and one would be for work if I could get a job someday. And this is the part that's important. I'm a retired physician with some physical disabilities, but a little remote data analysis would be awesome.
Isn't that a good story?
A very good story.
So you were a physician. Obviously, you got a lot of brains, a lot of talent, a lot of skills. You want to get into data analysis, which is you couldn't pick a better subject to get
right.
into. And he or she, was it?
Dr. Sorlian.
The good doctor has used Python, and they mentioned R.
R. And
which is a commonly used statistics program. And
SQL.
So in many cases, you'd be connecting to a server, and maybe you're doing the processing locally, maybe you're not. A Mac is a perfect choice because it's essentially a Unix box. So I drop out into the terminal almost always on the Macintosh. And when I'm in the terminal, R, Python, MySQL, SQL all work perfectly well, either locally or remotely using SSH. I've used Julia also. VS Code is a great choice for Python or Julia or R. I use Emacs, which also can be used for those languages. I'm very happy with Emacs and Lisp. So I think a MacBook is a great choice.
So they currently have a 13-inch MacBook with M1 and 16 gigs of RAM.
And I'm surprised they're getting this out of memory. I think that's a bug. I don't think that's legitimately out of memory.
I agree with you, too.
However, the new MacBook Air, which I'm using right now, goes up to 24 gigs. And a MacBook Pro goes up to 64 gigs. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that
I would get a MacBook Pro, to be honest, get the 14-inch, and I might wait because I'm still not unconvinced there'll be new MacBook Pros this month. So if you can hang out for the month of October, they won't announce it after October. So
right.
If you get through the next couple of weeks and they haven't announced it, go ahead and get the M2 MacBook Pro. 14.
Yeah.
I think that's a very good choice, not much more expensive. Do get more RAM, but again, we don't think that 16 should be enough.
I think 16 should be enough. The good doctor is using a third-party program that is sort of notifying about the RAM. If you're really concerned about the RAM, just use Activity Monitor itself and click on the memory tab and see. Because a third-party program might be being a little bit over... If you're using the first-party program, you're going to get a better idea and understanding of what's going on.
Eat the Oligarchs in RISC says RStudio loads everything into RAM.
Oh.
But, again, your code isn't that big.
Right.
Your code's a few K. I don't know how big RStudio is. Maybe those data sets have to all live in RAM. And I guess if you had giant data sets, okay, it's possible that you could run out of
RAM. So then maybe more RAM would be a good idea.
By the way, Keith's reminding me the MacBook Pro goes to 96 gigs. If I would say 32 is probably fine.
Yeah.
64 would be overkill.
The good doctor was wondering, because you and I have recommended a lot the Airs of the M2 variety, if that would be a good idea as the next machine.
That's why I'm saying get a Pro.
But
in this case,
you need more RAM.
But you know, Doc, how big your data sets are. So that's the question. I doubt they're that big. You know, we're able to use Stable Diffusion on a MacBook Air with 1.6 gigabyte models easily. There are bugs that can cause this out of memory error. I think that's more likely what's going on, is that something is not normal there. Now, it's one of the reasons I use Emacs. It's much more lightweight. Doesn't take up a lot of RAM.
If you want to, you know, reward yourself for completing the certification.
It's so great.
Then, bump up that RAM on a MacBook Pro and you'll be right on your way.
Yeah.
Now, do you recommend, so the doctor had mentioned some physical disabilities and maybe wanting a larger laptop because of that.
Get the 16 if you want.
Yeah, do you like the 16?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm going to buy the 14. Mm-hmm. And I actually made a note to myself, Leo, whatever happens, do not buy a new MacBook Pro until the OLED screens or the mini LED screens at the very least come out on an M3 processor. Mm-hmm. So I'm holding out, and I'm hoping that's going to be this month. I think it might be.
It'd be nice.
I think if it's not, the only issue is yields. TSMC's yields on the 3-nanometer process might not be as good as they were hoping, which means there's a shortage of those chips. That's the only reason. I know Apple has it ready, and Apple wants to release it. Let's put it that way. Yeah, I understand a generative AI model is not a data set. So Doc may be actually generating models through larger data sets. Out of sync. But first of all, most of the time people aren't creating those models locally, are they? They're using the cloud to do it. I feel like 16 gigs is an awful lot of memory. Is anybody in either of our IRCs or Discord, is anybody doing data science with a Mac and has a case for a larger RAM size? I don't know. I think you want a big screen. Actually, to be honest, you may be better off waiting and getting an M3 Max Studio with a large screen.
Oh, can't sit at a desk.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, needs to have a laptop.
See, you got
to
listen better. All right.
Thank you, Dr. Sorlean, in the Discord. That is the
username. That's a great question.
Yeah, I thought.
Thank you. And thanks for being in the club, Doctor.
Yes, thank you.
And I'm really thrilled that you did the EDX classes. By the way, my favorite. So I did a couple of EDX classes on functional programming using Racket that I really loved. There were the How to Design Programs, HTDP, by a legend, interestingly, in functional programming, Gregor Casales. Incredible. A Lisp legend actually taught the course, so that was great. But if you are looking for a free course that will give you a really nice basics in computer science, Harvard puts its CS50 course, the basic course that all Harvard freshmen take, I think. It's free. It's very well done, and it's available on EDX. Highly recommend it. That's if you just think you might be interested in computer science, CS50.
All right.
My colleague had to get, Sarah, who's in Norway, says, my colleague had to get the most amount of RAM possible to be able to run his models, an AI model. All right. Okay.
He might need
You can go up to 96 gigs.
Yeah.
If you need more than that, you're going PC, baby. Sorry to say. So the TD has his hand raised. You're not allowed to raise your hand, TD.
What? Oh, in the chat. I mean, in the Zoom?
Yeah. Should I go to...
Do you want to do a quick email or do you want to pick up a phone?
Oh, email. We haven't done another... Email. Time to stretch my rotator cuff.
Da, 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 da. Ooh, that crisp sound of paper.
How many trees died for this segment? Explain, says Michael from Mobile, Alabama. Explain to me, Micah.
All right. Fingers cracked.
I've been trying to find a good explanation of how the new Safari profiles work. Mm-hmm. All of the iOS 17 and Sonoma reviews gloss over explanation of this feature.
Fair enough.
I currently use Safari for my personal stuff and Chrome for my work stuff. He's using Google Workspace. That's why. I would like to just use a Safari work profile and stop using Chrome completely. Mm. Does the new Safari profiles feature support completely separate bookmarks and passwords, or is it just the browser cache history and extensions that are separate? I would also love to see a hands-on Mac deep dive episode on this
into profiles. You know what? It's on the list now. All right. So, with the introduction of iOS 17 as well as macOS Sonoma and all of the other 17s, Apple did introduce a new feature in Safari that's a lot like Chrome's own profile feature, where I'm going to sneeze.
Is that part of the profile, or is it Do you have to sneeze?
I guess I'm not going to sneeze.
Okay.
It went away because I acknowledged it. So
never acknowledge a sneeze.
You're right. Why?
Just
do
let
that?
It sneak up on you. Pretend I don't know you're coming. So profiles. I'm in Safari
yes.
here. How do I, first of all, how do I get into it? Create profile. Oh, there you go.
There you go.
It's under the file menu.
You've read it. So with profiles, you are able to essentially kind of relegate your information, your accounts, your extensions to different types of accounts. And most people do use this in Chrome as a way to have their work account tied to one and their personal account tied to another. So if you're curious about what actually is separated in profiles, you have history, cookies, and other data like your other kind of cookie information. Bookmarks are separated. Tab groups are separated. Your start page settings are separated. Your Safari extensions are separated.
Oh, that's good.
That's kind of the big one. So,
and it does this, it sets up the profile from the current settings in your Safari.
That is correct.
So get your Safari the way you want it
to be. You want
it
for your personal.
Then,
yes.
say,
then create your first profile.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And name it. You can give it a special icon that is specific to you and, you know, what would kind of be easy to recognize. I believe you can change the tint color as well. And then those settings.
So you'll know immediately whether you're using which profile.
Yes, exactly. That's which nice. Profile. And then you are able to kind of get everything.
It's a new profile.
Yes. And you'll notice so if you swipe your mouse up to the top, so that the screen kind of, you've only got one profile right now. So you would have to have
two. So let's do a new profile.
Yeah.
Okay.
Perhaps
manage your profiles.
Twit profile.
I'm going to make a new profile, and this is going to be called Twit for work only. And I'm going to use the hammer icon.
Boom.
And I'm going to make this be green. Okay. Green. So it's distinct from the other one. Oh, it's very green.
Yes.
And now I'm in Twit. You can see it says Twit, or I can choose
and then you just simply
to go
click
back
to
the other profile.
Yep.
Yeah. Switch to personal window. Switch to new profile. That's nice. So I foolishly named one my new profile. Don't do that.
Yes. Give it a good name.
Better. So I actually now have three. Personal window, my new profile, and I'm on Twit. And it's easy to switch right here at the switcher.
Yep. And basically your extensions will change between them. So maybe your work uses Bitwarden, a sponsor of the network, and you personally use 1Password. You can have an extension set up for just that. And what's great about it is the syncing that happens between your Mac and your phone and your iPad. So all of those
These profiles are now on my phone?
Yes. Those profiles will sync to your phone as well.
Magic.
And you can set them up exactly independently how you want to. When you clear your history, you can clear all of your history across all of your browsing or just the history of a selected profile. When you begin using a new profile, websites don't have the cookies or website data needed to remember you. So it starts it fresh if it's a new profile that you're creating.
Now here I am on my phone and I've got personal, my new profile. Where is it? There it is. And Twit. So those I just created those and already it's here on my phone. Look at that.
And what's great is if you do use those tab groups, then those are able to be separated.
Oh, yes. So the old tabs are gone.
Yep.
Oh, nice. Now I'm in the Twit.
You can go into work mode,
and there's
essentially.
No, there's
and
no
not
tabs.
Be distracted.
So all of those, you know, gambling and and liquor tabs are gone.
Right. Your horse bets. Yeah.
Yeah.
Horsebets.org.
That's good. That's good.
Yeah. And you could have a different start page maybe for what you do for work. So my start page for my Twit profile could be twit.tv. And I could have, special bookmarks that are just the meeting that we do on Tuesdays and that kind of thing.
That's so really handy.
Very handy.
There's only one downside. You have to use Safari.
Oh, I love Safari. So.
I'm a Firefox guy. True. But I have to say, there is an advantage to using the native browser, both on the iPhone and on Mac, because, you know, of things like this, it's built in.
And this is pretty neat, too. You can set it up in your website's settings so that specific links only open in certain profiles.
Wait a minute. So when you click the Google Docs for Ask the Tech Guys,
it could make sure that I'm in my work profile only. So that's actually pretty cool. I did not know that feature. I'm learning about that today. Yeah, that's a really handy feature. So yes, I will be doing a deep dive on Hands-On Mac about this.
Oh, good.
Because yeah, that is a very handy.
I didn't even, you know, this is funny because they come out with these new operating systems and you don't know all
the features. There are so many new features that end up getting rolled out.
You never know.
Thank you for that question. That was a great question and a great inspiration for another episode of HOM, Hands-On Mac.
Yes. Let's see here. I think we did, didn't we? Take a break. We're going to be back with more of your calls right now. More of your calls.
So there, I think we'll have time to do maybe just at least one more phone caller. Scott?
I pushed the wrong button. Richard.
Well, we're going to go with this person.
All right. I pushed Richard's buttons. Hi, Richard.
Hello, Richard.
This is Richard.
Where are you calling
Hello?
From, Richard?
Hello? Is somebody in control here?
Yeah, you're on.
I'm calling all the way from Santa Rosa.
Oh, it's old chef guy. It's our good friend, old chef guy. Hi, old chef guy.
Hi there. So I have I will dive right into Gmail spam question.
Oh.
When I put somebody, like a client, am I gone? Did I go away?
No. My OP was in reference to we have more questions about Gmail. This is good.
Okay. So I go into Gmail, I set somebody as a contact. Does that whitelist them?
That's really interesting.
That was once the way that one made sure that you would get emails. However,
I have
had a nice qualifier. That was good. That was a great qualifier.
They used to say, hey, if you want to get this newsletter, add us to your contacts.
If a domain or a specific email account has been marked as spam or phishing or one of those other things that's red in Gmail enough, then it falls under a certain score and may still end up in your spam account. So I will give you an example of this. I used to work at a company and we didn't have a standard username password login. It was username was your email. They would send you the email that has the quote unquote magic link, as they call it these days. And you click on the link to log in, right? For some reason, some fool at some point marked that as spam. And because it was not an email that was being used in a lot of places, one mark as spam was enough to drop it below that score. And so even though that email that was sending the magic link was in the contacts for my work, it would still end up in the spam folder because Gmail had looked at the ranking of the domain or whatever it happened to be and said, no, this is still spam. So we would have to go into the spam folder to find it to get the magic link. Finally, I don't know if maybe after a while they, look through it again or if there was some way to say, this isn't spam, I swear. But whatever happened, it did start showing up again. So I would say with Gmail specifically, I cannot confirm that adding someone as a contact is going to whitelist the email. I would say that it's a good idea to use the rules settings that Gmail has. Go ahead and add them as a contact, but also set up a rule that says if an email comes from at blah, 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 then put it in my inbox for sure.
Yeah, in fact, that's what I do.
Scooter X has a quote in Gmail. Whitelisting an email actually involves creating a filter, as we were talking about.
So it does create a filter automatically.
No. I think that what it's saying is you have to create a filter if you want to whitelist an email. That just setting them as a contact is not enough. You need to create a filter for it.
Explicitly.
Yeah, that's the way to whitelist.
Do it. Okay. That's how I do it on Fastmail, is I have a client
that we email each other when I'm producing online events for her. And there could be, 5 to 12 emails for setting up an event. And every one of them, insert bad words and bleep sounds, ends up in the spam folder. So in the middle of trying to get ready to produce, it's like not coming in. And she's saying, I sent it to you 10 minutes ago, and then I have to go find it. And so I have to create a rule to say when this email comes in from that person.
She has a lot of bad words in her emails? I know who that person is.
No, I have a lot of bad words.
Oh, you do?
Yes. Okay.
She's my old college roommate.
Yes. So, essentially, you just need to go in and create a filter. Having them in your contacts is not enough in Gmail. You You have to create a new filter.
And in the filter, there's a box that you check that says never send to spam.
Yep.
That's probably a better way anyway.
Yeah, no matter what, then you know it'll work.
Because it's very explicit, okay. Yeah.
And you can choose either a specific email address or you can choose a whole domain. So it gives you that, wild card option. And then will let you create the filter. That's a good question because people have that issue a lot, I think.
It's really annoying when you're trying to
produce. Thanks, Richard.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, when it's live.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you,
Richard. Great to talk to you. I'll see you at the Trader Joe's next week.
Exactly.
We keep running into each other.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
I'm buying my bourbon pecans. We have time for more. You thought we wouldn't, but we do. How about a voicemail? We haven't done a voicemail in 5 whole minutes. Well, I'd like to do more than one show.
Yeah, I'm looking at my countdown I keep here. It has been 6 minutes and 2 seconds.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Hey, guys. This is Frank from Los Angeles.
Hi, Frank.
Frank.
I had a question regarding getting data, which is text and voice messages off an iPhone of a deceased relative.
Ah, yes.
I do have access to her account, and she's actually on a shared account with myself, but for posterity reasons, I would love to get all her text messages and any voicemail and save those for the family for mementos. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
That's a great question. We get that question a lot. Apple's position is very clear, and this is true of Facebook. In fact, I just saw Mark Zuckerberg talking about this. Mm-hmm. It's very true of Google. They aren't going to assume that your deceased relative wanted you to have access to their messages. Maybe those were private, right?
Yeah.
I wouldn't necessarily assume that they want you.
Exactly. Yes.
Or their photos or anything else. So even if you have a death certificate and can prove that they were my relatives and so forth, they're not going to give you access to those, which is why it's a really good idea and most services allow you to do that. Apple definitely does, to establish a successor account.
Yep. A legacy contact.
I did that with Lisa, with my wife and with my kids. Because I don't have any secrets, and I want them to be able to access it. It's nice because, obviously, he also has done that, right? Mm-hmm. He does have access. Mm-hmm. So that's the good news. But we should say right up front, you can, rattle all the paperwork you want. You're not going to get these companies to give that stuff up because, quite rightly, they don't assume that your loved ones wanted you to have access to that stuff, right? So, very important as a person and all of us are in this boat, who will be deceased at some point. I'm sorry, Mikey, you probably didn't realize that, but it's true.
What?
It would be very, very important for you to plan for this because you could get hit by a bus. I mean,
Yeah.
So everybody should do this. Have a legacy contact. You can also, in your many password managers, have a chosen I don't know what they call it. It depends. Successor. So that the people who will be responsible for your estate or who just want to keep your memories and your pictures alive. I have 200,000 pictures in my Mileo. I want them to have access to those. Mm-hmm. So make sure you designate those successors. Now, since you have that access, it's easy.
Yeah. And in fact, I just received an email, I think a couple of days ago from a listener who said this. I just wanted to let you know I used the app iMazing a while ago and wanted to applaud you recommending it. I wanted to get my friend's mom's messages off her iPhone after she passed away. I used the app to archive the complete history of the messages into a Pages document for preservation. Nice. It exported 9 years of text messages and saved a history of her life. Wanted to let you know and thanks. I get chills. So
iMazing
is my suggestion. And look, the fact is you can do something similar, but it's much more difficult to do with just your Mac and your iPhone. If you plug, or even a Windows machine, if you plug it in and you do the backup and you go into the backup files and you look through them and you find and you put it all together, the much simpler way of doing this is just using iMazing. iMazing has a free trial. And when you use iMazing, it will let you do exactly this because that is part of what the application does. It lets you pull voicemails. It lets you pull messages. It lets you export them in files that are easy to use and share and view. And so that is why I recommend the program through and through. It is now they have a special version of the application that is for the folks who do forensics investigations. That is how robust and sort of powerful this application is at getting these things off of a phone as needed. So, yeah, that's my recommendation.
And I should say, there are many of us, I don't know if I would want my text messages to be available. You know, some text messages Lisa should get, but some text messages my kids should get.
Yeah, exactly.
But not necessarily all text messages for everyone.
All text messages.
And so I don't think that's an unreasonable thing for companies to assume.
I agree.
Same thing with pictures. They're protecting your privacy, and I think that that's reasonable.
Yeah, you don't know the relationship that the people had with the person who's passed.
Right, yeah. Good question.
Very good question.
Very good question. And I do want to thank Dr. Mom, who has given us the title for the show. Death is inherited as an autosomal dominant trait with 100% penetration.
Wow, taking me back to my genetics classes. Lord God.
Yes. So,
That Punnett square.
I think it's easy to pretend that you're not going to die, but we're all doing it.
Yeah.
We're all in the process of doing it. And so, if you do want to preserve some stuff, make arrangements now, just because you may not have a chance later. I know that's kind of morbid.
No. But I mean, it may be for some.
It's interesting because
also just truth.
When big tech started, we were all young.
Yes.
In the blush of our
youth. We were all young.
And we didn't think about this stuff. But I saw Zuckerberg say, every day thousands of Facebook users die. And so it's, and they have ways on Facebook to memorialize an account and so forth. I think, by the way, that's a very nice way to do
it. I agree.
I really like what
that
they've done
there. Clever and good.
Yeah. Because the account doesn't go away, but becomes now a kind of a guest book, a thank you to the past.
It's a little I don't know, maybe this sounds morbid too, but I don't think so. Like an online gravesite almost. Why do we go to gravesites? It is to remember the person.
Much better, really, to go to their Facebook page.
Yeah.
Than to go to some piece of rock in a nice garden. So,
sometimes
I'm just getting a little morbid, aren't I? I apologize.
Well,
what about your Netflix subscription? By the way, I just logged into Hulu. They said, it's going to be $18 starting soon. Netflix, Wall Street Journal saying, as soon as this SAG strike's over, they're going to... pretty soon it's going to cost so much money to watch TV. You should just watch this show.
Yep.
Watch Twit. It's free. Or $7. But $7 is still cheaper. But you know what? You can still do it for free. If you just have to sit through the ads. That's all. Everybody, we are out of time. I'm sad to say the clock on the wall says you're out of time.
We're out of time.
So I thank you so much for being here. I'm glad we could do this show. It's a lot of fun. Tip of the hat to our club members.
Yes, indeed.
Who make it all possible. Thanks to our producer, John Ashley, to our studio manager, Jammer Beat, John Slenina. We got two Johns in here, which is good. No waiting. And then, thanks to Burke McQuinn, who makes sure everything is broken and then fixes it. It's a two part job. He Burks it and then he
Burks it and he unburks it.
It's job security.
No, Burke, we love you. Burke is Burke. We love Burke. And Kim, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, Kim
Schaffer
from
the old radio show hung out with us in the IRC. You can come by, Kim, anytime you want. Come and say hi.
Get some coffee.
Yeah, get some coffee. If you want to call us during the week, so we do this show on Sundays between about 11 a.m. Pacific and 1:30 p.m. Pacific. Sorry, Chris.
Hi, Mr. Coffee.
Chris Coffee Guy. We ran out of time. Didn't have enough time. Sorry. But we love you, Chris. So if you're watching during that time, roughly 2 to 5 Eastern time, 1850 or 1800 UTC. If you're watching that time, then you call the phone number. You can be on the air with us live, and that's nice. We love that.
We do.
888-724-2884. But if you're not watching in that time frame, you'll just be able to leave a message and voice messages as you hear. We love them. So
I do. Yeah, I love all of these ways that you're able to get in touch with us. And yeah, it's a warm feeling that you all want our help. I love that. I like feeling needed.
If we keep sitting here, I'm going to have a warm feeling. So we better wrap this up. Call.twit.tv. I'm terrible. I apologize.
That's the URL. 888-724-2884 again. The phone number and ATG@twit.tv is the email. Thank you all for tuning in to this week's episode of Ask the Tech Guys. That's Leo Laporte.
That's Micah Sargent.
Have a great geek week.
Bye-bye. Hey, we should talk Linux. It's the operating system that runs the internet, a bunch of game consoles, cell phones, and maybe even the machine on your desk. But you already knew all that. What you may not know is that TwitNow has a show dedicated to it, the Untitled Linux Show. Whether you're a Linux pro, a burgeoning sysadmin, or just curious what the big deal is, you should join us on the Club Twit Discord every Saturday afternoon for news, analysis, and tips to sharpen your Linux skills. And then make sure you subscribe to the Club Twit exclusive Untitled Linux Show. Wait, you're not a Club Twit member yet? Well, go to twit.tv/clubtwit and sign up. Hope to see you there.